If there was a time when the Allies could have lost World War II, one of the best candidates for that time would be the fall of 1943. This is when the Allies were launching massive bombing raids into the heart of Germany, but their B-17 bombers went unescorted without any fighters to help them. Now, B-17s were formidable. They had a crew of 10 and carried 12 50 caliber machine guns pointing in all directions. The problem is, when they went on bombing runs, they would have to fly straight toward their target, no matter what they came across, and there were no fighters that had enough range to assist them when they flew out of Britain and into Germany. This is when the German fighters struck. B-17s erupted into flames, puffs of flak appeared all around them, and when they were struck, bomber crews would desperately try to bail out. Of the 229 fortresses that were part of a bombing raid on the city of Schweinfurt, 60 were shot down and 17 more were lost on the way home. These were unsustainable losses. Air crews were grounded, some men talked of mutiny, and there were quiet fears that the entire European war effort was coming apart. But arguably what changed everything was the P-51 Mustang. It was the fastest plane the US Army Air Forces had ever developed, and it could outfly any German fighter in the skies. It could go over 400 miles an hour, most importantly it had a range of over 2,000 miles, and could accompany any bomber into Germany. German military intelligence was horrified when they saw Allied fighters over their skies, and some knew that the war was over at that point. To talk about the importance of the P-51 are today's guests, David and Margaret White, authors of the book Wings of War, the World War II fighter planes that saved the Allies and believers who made it fly. We look at how the plane gained its reputation and how it nearly didn't make it to the skies at all. It was designed and delivered in only 100 days, and it was a metaphorical and literal crash course of cutting-edge technology. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with David and Margaret White. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Before getting into the specs of the P-51, the people who brought it about and introduced it to the European theater, I figure it's useful to see what the state of the war was like before the P-51 came about, because we can see how it changed things. Your book opens with a 1943 Schweinfurt raid. This is when bombers are going on German bombing raids completely unassisted, like the movie Memphis Belle. They are in a box formation. Each B-17 has multiple 50 caliber machine guns, but despite that, there's a feeling among flight crews that they're sitting ducks. So can you tell me about this raid and others and what it was like when they went out without the assistance of fighters?
Most people don't really grasp the fact that there were two points at which the Allies almost lost the Second World War. The first was in the winter of 1943, when Hitler's U-boats at sea were sinking everything, all the freighter convoys coming from North America. The second time was in the autumn of 1943, when the U.S. Air Force, without the Mustangs, was being torn to shreds. In 1943, many of the raids were suffering 75% bombing losses, and thousands of young men were going to their deaths. And it was a very bleak picture indeed. And the Navy was useless. It couldn't invade Germany. It was confined to the sea. The Army had yet to land, so there was no land war yet in 1943. And the only way to get to Germany, the only way to strike with the Allied fist of Germany, was by the bombers, by air. And if the bombers couldn't strike, then you couldn't get to Germany. And also, you couldn't have D-Day, because you needed air superiority, command of the air, to cover any invasion forces at winter. So in 1943, things looked very bleak indeed, and the Allied leaders were wondering what the heck is going to happen, and is the Luftwaffe just going to destroy our air force and stymie our war? So those two points, winter of 1943 and autumn of 1943, were very bleak moments indeed for the Allied leadership.
With the bombing raids in particular, what was it like when they went out without escorts, when the escorts that did assist them had limited range and they could accompany them maybe to about Belgium or so, but then eventually they had to turn back? So what was it like for those flight crews and what challenges did they encounter?
Well, you've hit on the biggest problem, was that all of the Allied fighters couldn't fly as far as the interior of Germany to cover and protect the bombers. So the bombers were going in alone, and the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, would just pounce on the bombers as soon as the inadequate fighter escort left or turned around. The first fighter, P-47 Thunderbolt, just didn't have the range. It couldn't get in over Germany. And the second fighter, the P-38 Lightning, had many, many engine troubles and had a terrible time with its engine troubles. And more often than not, these planes would have to turn back at the border. And then, as I say, the Luftwaffe was free to pounce on the unprotected bombers. And these raids were just gruesome. You can imagine a 10-man flight crew rattling around in a bomber under furious attack in the freezing cold, high altitude, and men often suffering grievous wounds and having to fight and keep attacking and defending for an hour and a half with all the guns blazing. And many of the bombers would limp back home with terrible casualties among their crews.
Might add that the casualties in numerical terms were terrible. At the worst, which was around the time of Schweinfurt, late summer, fall of 1943, on these missions, up to 25% of flight crews were lost. And if you count all the bombers that were damaged beyond repair, there were missions on which the Allies were losing up to 75% of their bombers, which could not be replaced. So as we say in the book, the Allies were really reaching the floor of a very deep pit at this point in the war.
There's an interesting point made in the beginning of the book when in 1943, flight crews are grounded. There's worries of a potential mutiny. Can you describe more about this low point? I figure it's worth understanding because we forget about this as we rush in our narrative toward victory after victory at the end of the war and the pounding of the German military.
It really got so bad that in October of 1943, the Air Force essentially just stopped flying. The Air Force called a halt to all operations between October 1943 and February of 1944, and they just closed down. And the brass, the higher up, said it was because of weather, but the general picture was that it was because they were just being so savagely defeated and mauled. During this time, the bomber crews had suffered tremendous psychological wounds. It was a new kind of warfare. You had the ships had many days between battles and had to steam to the enemy to engage them. Armies, too, had to march through over long distances before they engaged the enemy. But pilots went up in planes day after day after day, and it was a relentless facing of doom, which was ceaseless and constant. The warfare was much faster than anything else. An army marches at about 30 miles an hour, and battles are protracted, and ships are slow moving. But battle in the air took place at hundreds of miles an hour with the speed of flying bullets. All of this placed a great strain on the crews, and the Air Force really led some of the pioneering experiments in psychological reaction to warfare. The CME, the Central Medical Establishment, organized a network of flight surgeons to take care of the bomb, to take care of the crews, and to treat their psychological wounds because they were losing so many men to operational fatigue and combat fatigue that they knew they had to treat these men psychologically to keep them in the air. Very often, drugs like Emmetol were used to relax a patient, relax an airman, and let them relive traumatic experiences. The CME had a network of so-called flak farms, which were country estates made over into resorts where men who had been through living hell could go and recuperate and recover. There was a whole network of flight surgeons to treat the psychological damage to the young air crews, which was really the first major military foray into psychiatric medicine.
Thank you for describing the low point of the war, because that gives us context about the difference that the P-51 makes. We'll get into all of the specs of the plane, its development, and all the challenges that came out. But first, let's jump forward and look at the state of affairs after it's developed, when it is accompanying these bombing raids into Germany, when these bomb formations do have fighters on their side that are doing battle with Messerschmitts and other German fighters. So can you tell me how the bombing raids changed after the P-51s began to assist them?
Well, P-51 completely turned the tables, and with stunning speed, P-51 entered service, came into the battle in January of 1944, and in 6 months, it wiped out the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe, which it had 5,000 aircraft, was reduced to 200 airplanes on D-Day. It was really just a stunning feat of arms. There were two advantages that the Germans just couldn't deal with. One, it was such a high-performance aircraft that it could outfly anything that Germany had. And the P-51s were just wiping off the skies with their superior performance. On top of the high performance, it was the first fighter that had this immensely important long range. And it was the first fighter that could accompany the bombers into Germany and then accompany them, as importantly, back out. And the German pilots were stunned when they saw the P-51 coming in over Berlin and over the interior German cities. And they just were absolutely stunned to see American fighters penetrating so far into Germany. So a superior performance and long range were completely game changers. And they really let the P-51 take over the battle. Hermann Göring, the chief of the Air Force, said, "When I saw your fighters over Hanover, I began to be scared. When I saw your fighters over Berlin, I knew the jig was up." So Göring himself realized that if the P-51 could insert the bombers to any location around Germany, they had lost the air war, which was critical to the whole rest of the war.
Absolutely. The planners of D-Day, if they credit one thing for it being possible, it would be air supremacy. And because they controlled the skies, it was possible to launch a land war. If they had tried to do something like that in 1943, the troops simply would have been bombed into oblivion. It would have been a bloodbath. Let's look at the specs of the P-51 itself and why it was able to rule the skies. And also compare it to other fighters of the time. So can you describe its speed, its how quickly it could gain altitude, number of machine guns, its range, et cetera. So could you describe these factors and then also how it compared to the fighters of its time?
The P-51 was a breakthrough aircraft, a revolutionary aircraft. It had tremendous speed, 427 miles an hour at 21,500 feet. It had a tremendous climb. It climbed from the ground to about 30,000 feet in 10 or 15 minutes. It could climbed 28 feet per second. It had this long range of flying over 2,000 miles, and it was just a revolutionary aircraft and a breakthrough one, as I say. There were many design elements that were new, that had never been seen before, and it looked different. It was much more curvaceous. It had a futuristic look to it. It had a low underslung air intake under its wings, which gave it a menacing look. And the pilots just loved it. One of them said, "You didn't feel like you flew the Mustang, you felt like you wore the Mustang." And all the pilots who said it, who flew it, was called a, quote, sweet, unquote, airplane. It was called a sweet airplane. And it handled with marvelous ease and marvelous maneuverability and really did much to turn around the air war in Germany.
And in terms of firepower, how much did it pack?
There were two versions of the P-51, which really turned the corner in the war. The first was the P-51B, as in boy. The P-51B had four 50-caliber machine guns, and the P-51D, which superseded the B, had six 50-caliber machine guns. So the D was really beefed up, and it was a very heavily armed aircraft, and it just tore through the Luftwaffe in those 6 months before D-Day like a knife through butter. It was really just a phenomenal performance, and it really saved the Allies in that terribly bleak winter.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. I'm curious about the development of the P-51. Something interesting with World War II is how quickly these radically differently designed aircraft or sometimes vehicles are planned, go into production, in a time scale that could be 3 to 4 times faster if it were in peacetime. So what were the challenges of the development of the P-51, where it was sometimes a metaphorical and sometimes a literal crash development? What was that process like?
Well, the P-51 was fast-tracked and developed super quickly by a very small team of men. I mean, there weren't hundreds of engineers and there weren't months and months of development because the British were fighting a war. Incidentally, the British really were the ones who first used the P-51 in 1940 when it was developed. They commissioned the P-51 from North American Aviation in Los Angeles, California. The development was fast-tracked by North American because the British wanted the plane as soon as they could get it. The plane was designed in 102 days. The British had specified they wanted it in 100 days. So North American was 2 days late, which is pretty good, pretty amazing. And the team designed it, which consisted of 14 men, which is a very small group. The inventor of the Mustang, Ed Schmood, had his men and in a trusty crew, and there were teams assigned to all the aspects of design: wings, fuselage, propulsion, gunnery, cockpit, controls. All of these had a team of one or two men working on. At peak production, Schmood's team swelled to about 40 men, but then it came back down to about 12 or 14 and remained a very small group until the end. There were many firsts, many breakthroughs on the P-51, and they were really bringing into life a new breed of Predator.
You have to remember, too, that in the summer of 1940, when the British commissioned this airplane, the Battle of Britain was well underway, and Britain was really under siege. So there was real urgency about getting this airplane done. By the time it was finished and ready for delivery in 1941, the whole landscape of the British air war had changed because the FW-190, the new German fighter, had appeared in the skies, and the British realized that they were in real trouble. They had nothing they could put up against it. The Spitfire, which had been the champion of the Battle of Britain, was not equal to this new German plane. And so the British knew there was trouble ahead.
The P-51 was even an outcast in the beginning. Despite all of its innovations and breakthroughs, not everyone accepted it at first. What was the reason for that?
Well, there were several reasons for it. Before I answer that, I just want to throw in that the P-51 underwent a game-changing alteration. The British put a new British engine, a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, into it. And that then the P-51A turned into the P-51B, which really was the breakthrough Mustang and which took off and defeated the Germans. But this industrial transplant of a Merlin, Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, for an American Allison engine, really transformed the P-58 into a world beater.
The British, when they took delivery on the P-51A in 1941, didn't have need for a plane that was as fast or as maneuverable as the Mustang eventually became. But with the appearance of the FW-190, they knew that they needed more speed. And the Rolls-Royce company, which had made the Merlin engines for essentially all the planes that flew in the Battle of Britain, had this new engine, the Merlin, the 61. And the RAF had the idea of putting it in the Mustang. And they did that, and it was revolutionary. The Mustang was transformed from a good airplane to a fantastic airplane.
Can you discuss any more design breakthroughs that the P-51 included? It was faster than any other fighter at the time. It had longer range. What were particular breakthroughs that enabled it to be the fighting aircraft that it was?
There were several brand new, first time ever innovations on the Mustang, which, as I said, was in many ways a very futuristic aircraft. The first was a new type of wing that the Army Air Forces were testing, but it had never been used by a private company before. And North American Aviation was the first to use it. It was called the Laminar Flow Wing. The laminar flow wing essentially had a bigger bulge on the top of the wing, which increased lift tremendously. And that helped the Mustang. The second breakthrough was in the streamlining of the fuselage. The fuselage used something called second-degree curves. Drouet used second-degree curves in designing the Mustang, and that was a first. That had never been done before. Second-degree curves are sections of a cone which are cut off so they get smaller and smaller and smaller, and the fuselage is designed with those second-degree curves making for a super streamlined airplane. And many, many people in the Royal Air Force, the British Royal Air Force, and the American Air Force were just stunned at the maneuverability and streamline of the Mustang. The third breakthrough was the remarkably thin skin that the Mustang had. I think it was about 1/50th of an inch in many parts. No, it was about 1/50th of an inch in many places. And it was just much, much thinner and lighter than any metal that had been used in producing an aircraft before. It was something called dynamic balance that North American used, and it essentially involved the balance between the nose of the airplane and the tail. And there were other innovations. The cockpit was a rounded bubble cockpit from which the pilot could see behind airplanes attacking from the rear. So when the P-51B went into combat, there were many, many firsts that had never been seen in a fighter plane before.
Just because it was a superior piece of technology doesn't mean that it will automatically be adopted by a military. This is something I think is lost when we think about military technology, that if something superior is designed and has better specs than the thing before it, people will want to have it. And this isn't the case. I mean, there can be factions within a military that have vested interests in keeping old technology around. Maybe they want something that is over-engineered. Germany was famous or infamous for this at the end of the war. For all their vaulted super weapons, many of the things they had were so over-engineered, like gigantic guns that had to be transported by railway, that maybe they could fire an impressive shot, but they weren't effective because they required so much other technology that they weren't much beyond psyops. But this isn't the case with the P-51, because there are people who not only make sure that the manufacturing that requires it to be producing great numbers are there, but you have people that can demonstrate its technology and why it's superior, flying aces as well. And these are people you focus on in your book, particularly Edgar Schmood, who envisions it. There's Tommy Hitchcock, who's the business titan, who helps produce it, and Don Blakesley, who's a flying ace. So could you tell me about these particular figures? And let's start with Edgar Schmood.
Well, Edgar Schmood was a German emigre. He had been born at the turn of the century, 1900, which was really when aviation began with the Wright brothers. So he kind of grew up with aviation, and he had thought about it all his childhood, all his adolescent years. He had dreamed of designing a great fighter. He made his way from a fairly impoverished background in Germany via South America to California, where most of the early airplane manufacturers were then located. Had a job with North American, which was then an upstart aviation company, and then North American got the order for the P-51. By that point, Schmood, who had dreamed of airplanes all his life, already had his design for an ideal fighter literally in his pocket. And that was a lot of why he was able to design this plane and get it made so quickly. The problem, though, was that after it was delivered to the British in 1941, and the British understood after testing it what a fantastic plane it was and how much better it could be with a British engine, were not able to interest the Americans in this plane. By then, the 8th Air Force was forming up in England, beginning in very early 1942, following Pearl Harbor. And so there were a number of American Air Force generals in Britain. And the second main character in our book, Tommy Hitchcock, who was the air attaché at the American Embassy, began trying to woo these generals to convince them that the Mustang was the answer to the Allies' problem with the Germans in the air. He realized
fairly quickly that he needed to get to the higher-ups at the Pentagon in Washington before this airplane was going to be able to be produced in any numbers. And so he traveled to the States and began this lobbying effort in Washington and crisscrossing the country, meeting with the press, meeting with the Air Force procurement people at Wright Field to try to convince them that this was a great airplane and that the U.S. should be producing it in large numbers. He finally succeeded in doing that, although it was a protracted process and there was a lot of Air Force resistance to the airplane. But finally, in late 1943, North American got the order to make literally thousands of Mustangs, and it arrived in England just at the very end of 1943, but in time to get in over Germany with the bombers and decimate the Luftwaffe. And I think the number of Mustangs finally manufactured by the end of the war was about 15,000. So once production was ramped up, it was very effective.
And can you tell me about Don Blakeslee, how he demonstrates the effectiveness of the P-51?
Well, Don Blakeslee was a great fighter pilot who had actually been flying for the British, as had many young Americans who loved to fly and wanting to get into the war before we were even in. So in early 1941, he, like many American boys, signed up with the Canadian Air Force, the Royal Canadian Air Force, and got himself to England and flew with what were then called the Eagle Squadrons. They were squadrons of American fighter pilots who flew for the British and were then, once the Americans got over there in the spring of 42, they were subsumed into the 8th Air Force. So Don Blakeslee had a lot of experience flying fighters. And when the Mustang finally arrived in England in very late 1943, he was assigned to fly this plane and to teach the first fighter group to get it to fly it. When he did fly it, he was simply overwhelmed. He thought it was the greatest fighter that he had ever flown from every point of view, speed, maneuverability, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a problem at that point, even though the Air Force had finally decided to produce it, they somehow did not yet understand that this was a plane that should be doing bomber escort over Germany. And so they assigned it not to the 8th Air Force for bomber escort, but to the 9th Air Force for strategic duty. And Don Blakeslee decided that he should be his job to convince the Air Force generals that they needed to move this plane from the 9th to the 8th Air Force. And that is exactly what he did. He lobbied until he got them to take the P-51s that had arrived in England and give them all to the 8th Air Force. And at that point, which was very early 1944, the Mustangs could begin accompanying the bombers in force over Germany on their missions. So Don Blakeslee was the guy who really got the plane where it needed to be in order to prepare for the D-Day invasion.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
And he was really quite a character. He was the epitome of a hard-driving, hard-charging fighter ace. He had shot down about 15 airplanes himself, which was quite a record. And it was said he could drink all night and fly all day the next day. And he was really an A-type male to the nth degree. He was once caught with not one but two women in his room. And the general who was considering his promotion to lieutenant colonel said, "Hell, two women in his room? I'll make this guy a full colonel." But he was very aggressive and hard-charging fighter ace.
Taking a step back and looking at the overall effects of the P-51 on the war, what would you say? Let's say you're a military strategist in 1945 and 1946, and you're looking back at the war and writing up analysis and report for a committee. We see the effects that it had in 1943, but in other theaters of war and the overall war effort, how would you characterize its effect?
The P-51 really turned all of World War II around, and it's not excessive to say that the P-51 was the key weapon of World War II, which enabled the Allied victory. As I said before, you couldn't strike by sea. There were no land armies until D-Day in June of 1944, and the air war was critical to the whole rest of the war. And the air war, in the end, came to boil down to fighter supremacy and being able to boost the best fighters. And that was the P-51. When it came in 1944, it just chewed through the Luftwaffe. And with air superiority, D-Day could go forward, and the land armies could land, and the land armies could advance across France, occupied France and Germany. So the P-51 was really the thing that turned the air war, and the air war turned all of World War II. And I don't think it's excessive to say P-51 was a critical element, a critical weapon in the whole victory of World War II.
With all this in mind and understanding the importance that it had, because these workhorse vehicles can sometimes be sidelined with things like the atomic bomb or the Manhattan Project when we think about the most important components of winning a war, what do you hope that readers take away from your book when they think about the P-51 and the people who made it possible?
Well, I think we hope they'll find heroes. This is a curious age without many heroes, and it's a curious age of difficulty in which there aren't many heroic actions. And these guys were real heroes. The fighter pilots who flew them were heroic and performed remarkable feats and were a real breed of American tough guy, dating back to cowboys and dating back to Yanks in World War I. The pilots were heroes. The way in which Schmood's team worked feverishly, producing the Mustang in 102 days, was another remarkable action. Schmood and his narcotic fascination with aviation, which had begun when he was a boy, living in poverty in Germany. His father was a dentist who didn't make much money, and the family often had to go hungry. Schmued went from being dirt poor in his boyhood Germany to being one of the most prominent aviation design figures in American history. Hitchcock was really the same kind of hero. He had been very successful across the board in banking. He was a partner at Lehman Brothers, the famous white shoe investment banking firm on Wall Street. He had been a fighter pilot himself in World War I. He had made a lot of money, and he was a polo player. He was a star polo player, and it's said that he was the best polo player in the history of the sport. He was another titan amid the world at that time. He did so much to bring the P-51 to fruition. And if there's anything that I hope readers take from the book, it's this sense of heroes now lost in the difficulties of the present age. And I hope that people take a real look at some men who gathered human will, performed remarkable feats.
Yeah, we call the book Wings of War, the fighter plane that saved the Allies, and the believers who made it fly. And this book is really about three individuals who, against the odds, believed in this airplane and put everything on the line to get it in the air. But I hope people take away from this that the importance of one individual is still critical, even in an age where things are not apparently about individuals so much anymore.
Well, thank you for sharing these stories with us. There are many more we couldn't get to. And for listeners who do want to check that out, as Margaret mentioned, the name is Wings of War, the World War II fighter planes that saved the Allies and the believers who made it fly. David and Margaret, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.